ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly. And we come to you today from the sunny, sunny Gold Coast. But more about that later.
This week, the streaming giants are going to be forced to funnel money into Australian productions.
And we have more details about the looming social media ban for young people. But somehow, the whole thing is more confusing than ever.
Well, after literally years of people calling for it, the government is making international streamers invest in Australian content.
Yeah, so the federal government introduced legislation this week to mandate that any streaming service with more than 1 million Australian subscribers must produce Australian drama, children's, documentary, arts or educational programs.
Now, Viv, we still don't know completely how it will work, but we certainly know a lot more than we did previously. What we can, I think, be confident on is that it is going to mean a lot more money being spent on creating that sort of content, particularly for TV series, but also films as well. And depending how you look at it, I think a conservative estimate is probably at least $300 to $400 million a year. So that will make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, the streamers often argued that they didn't need quotas. They already made Australian shows. There was Colin from Accounts on Binge. There's been various shows such as Bloom on Stan. Netflix has dabbled in Australian content as well with Apple Cider Vinegar and all sorts of shows. So they were saying, we don't need legislation, we do it anyway. But some people felt like there was a disconnect because free-to-air television stations do have to make Australian content. So they were going, well, we're forced to make this. Why aren't they? Why are they reaping billions of dollars from Australian consumers and not giving something back? I guess the concern now is legislation with good intentions can sometimes have unintentional consequences. So they've got to look at the loopholes and what sorts of things they will actually make the streamers do.
What loopholes have you spotted?
Well, I know that there are some lobbyists out there who are concerned that it needs to be clear in its language. So could you just buy the back catalogue of Neighbours, for example, stick that at the back of your streaming service with no prominence, no discoverability, and then say, well, we paid for Australian content. What they also want to make sure is that there are Australian producers, Australian actors, Australian writers, not just a show that's filmed on the Gold Coast, for example, because there's some government offset. Now, that does have an economic benefit, but we need to think about what defines an Australian story and how many Australians are involved and where that money funnels to, basically.
Yeah, that's a very good point because, yeah, a lot of those sort of movies which get Australian funding because they're made here, and I'm thinking of things like Elvis, for instance, or The Great Gatsby, involve lots of Australian crew, but obviously wasn't an Australian story. So that's the question is does it have to kind of contribute to Australia's culture in some way as well?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that this is happening in 2025 when this was something that was first flagged back in 2023 when the Albanese Labor government released their Revive cultural policy. It was meant to be in play, I believe, in July last year. And now we're in November 2025 somehow, and we're hearing about it again. Now, that's partly because it seems like perhaps trade negotiations with the US have settled. The Labor government said it was difficult to get this done when America was in the midst of an election and they didn't want Trump to suddenly implement tariffs on us as a retaliation for us spending money on Australian productions. So it's back on the agenda. But as we know with these things, they talk about things and then there's the reality of actually getting it done. And I think we're still quite a long way away from that. Speaking of things that seem a long way away but may not be, we learned this week about Australia's impending social media ban for children under 16.
We did learn a little bit more, Viv. That's right. hey, given that it's only about 4 weeks now to go until the law comes into effect, there are still some things which aren't entirely clear. But to talk about what we do now know, what we learned this week, one of the key things is what looks like the final list of the initial 8 services which are going to be covered. So we now know that Reddit and the live streaming platform Kick will be included, and that will be alongside Snapchat, TikTok, YouTube, X, Facebook and Instagram. So in theory, anyone under the age of 15 will no longer be allowed to have an account with those services.
It's so interesting what has been designated and what hasn't. And I can imagine if you worked for a certain company that was within that, you might feel like, why us? It does feel like the definitions are changing, and it seems like online social interaction is now the target. One thing that we'll have to look out for, though, is WhatsApp, for example, is owned by Meta, which also owns Facebook and Instagram and Threads, which is included in the ban. WhatsApp isn't, because that's essentially a messaging platform. But you can also now put a status on WhatsApp. Is that going to sort of force these things, such as stories, such as status updates, such as sharing pictures? Will those ones that aren't designated and aren't included in the social media ban find sneaky ways to implement those tools and those tactics, particularly when they're owned by the same billionaire being Mark Zuckerberg?
Look, it is. It has the potential to become a sort of giant game of whack-a-mole where younger people sort of move across to other services. One of the things that fascinates me is how much the kind of the drumbeat this week has suddenly got louder around Roblox, which is an online kind of games platform for children. And suddenly I'm seeing so much reporting in the media this week, from The Guardian, from News Corp titles. We're seeing things happening in the US, raising questions about the safety of that platform. So it feels like the final list is not going to be the final list.
So that isn't included in the ban?
Not currently. And I think all of a sudden that's one of those kind of edge cases where everyone is saying, well, shouldn't it be? So it does feel like we're going to keep having this conversation about who might be added. And of course, we have seen the eSafety Commissioner kind of flag the fact that there will be more sort of looked at later. And I should probably mention as well, we have invited on a number of occasions the eSafety Commissioner to join us, and our invitation remains open.
I just wonder if it will have consequences for people who aren't under 16, and what the user experience for people in their 30s, 40s, 50s and beyond will be like when it's evident that we're not under 16. But what kinds of traps are we going to get caught up in?
Look, I think I may have said this before, but please accidentally lock me out.
That's an official request to Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, who I'm sure is an avid Medialand listener, Tim.
Do it, Zuck. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly. The 11th of November, which is this coming Tuesday, is a significant date for the history of Australian politics.
That's right, Viv. And this year it marks the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of Gough Whitlam's government, heralding a blizzard of political change.
It was a turbulent day, week, month, probably a turbulent few years, really, for the political journalists in the Canberra Press Gallery at the time. And nothing was quite the same again.
Tom McElroy is the political editor of The Guardian Australia and has been talking to the reporters who covered the big weeks 50 years ago.
He's in our studios in Parliament House in Canberra. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Viv. Hi, Tim. Great to be with you.
So, look, for those of us who didn't grow up with the story, you know, it was before I was born and Tim would have been back in the UK at the time. What was the dismissal? What are we talking about when we use those words?
Well, I'd start by saying that I wasn't born either, but it's been, as a political nerd, it's been great looking back on it and the role of the press gallery. The dismissal was the culmination of a constitutional crisis here in Canberra. It's the only time it's happened. The Governor General of the day, Sir John Kerr, used the reserve powers of his office in the Constitution to dismiss the government and sack Gough Whitlam as the Prime Minister. And the thing that sparked this was a decision by the coalition opposition, led at the time by Malcolm Fraser, to block supply, essentially cut off government money in the Senate, refusing to pass the budget bills, and amping up pressure over days and weeks against Labor until they were almost running out of money and Gough Whitlam was painted into a corner and some resolution was needed. The nuclear option is what eventuated and the government was dismissed from office.
And why do we talk so much about the 11th as the specific day?
It's probably the most famous day in Australian politics. It's the day that Kerr intervened, something that had never happened before and has never happened since. And it was a day of high drama. The place that we call Old Parliament House now was abuzz as this legislative blockade effectively drove the government out of office. And down the road at Yarralumla, at Government House, John Kerr put in plan a set of steps that would change the course of political history and end the three-year Whitlam government in pretty dramatic scenes.
I remember learning about this at school, Tom, and there's sort of an iconic media moment where Gough Whitlam gives a press conference and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, well may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General."
Very good.
I obviously didn't deliver that quite as well as Gough did because I don't have the pent-up rage in me of losing my job. But you've spoken to journalists who covered it and were probably there at the time. Was that a key memory for them? What was it like on the ground?
I think it's a key memory for everyone who was around at the time. It's probably one of the iconic moments of Canberra's history and Australian political history. It was about 10 to 5 in the afternoon on the 11th of November, 50 years ago, of course. And the drama had been playing out all day. The government had been dismissed just after lunchtime. Gough Whitlam was summoned to Government House, Malcolm Fraser as well. One leader was removed from office and the other was installed as caretaker prime minister. And in the hours after those dramatic events, the Canberra Press Gallery found out exactly what was going on almost at the same time as some of the political players. There's fantastic history. Paul Kelly, the revered journalist still working with The Australian today, tells a story of a statement explaining what had happened being passed to journalists in the press gallery at Old Parliament House and their hands quivering as they read this quite extraordinary news. He was a 28-year-old political correspondent covering the biggest story of his career, and people like Laurie Oakes, Michelle Grattan, Andrew Clark, some of the big names of Australian journalism, really made their careers that day covering extraordinary news.
Yeah, how do some of those reflect on it? Well, what was Laurie Oakes doing at the time?
I used Laurie Oakes as the framing for the Meanjin essay that I've written. You know, there aren't many names bigger in Australian political journalism than Laurie Oakes. He was out for lunch. He was across the road from Old Parliament House at the lobby restaurant, and he tells a story about being told that the government had been dismissed, standing up from the table and running back to Parliament. Michelle Grattan, who is a doyen of the press gallery and still working here today, was getting ready for what she was expecting to come, an election campaign to resolve the crisis, and heard on the radio that the government had been dismissed. Andrew Clark, who was working for the National Times, was in the building. This news went around like a firecracker, people telling each other one by one that the government had been removed. And when you read the history, you can feel the febrile nature of the building and how this news spread. I think some of the journalists knew that the government had been dismissed before Labor MPs knew. And of course, the budget bills were being debated in the Senate. And the way and the time that people found out really helps change the course of history.
If this happened in 2025 rather than 1975, social media would be playing a huge role in both how we got to a certain point and then how the news was spread. It was obviously a very different landscape in 1975. How big a player was the media in hastening these events? You know, were they a part of what unfolded, or were they merely observing what unfolded?
It's a great question. My sense from looking back and reading some of the history from the time, reading news reports and having the opportunity to talk to people, is that the media were definitely part of the drama. The way Old Parliament House is situated, some of your listeners might have visited, it's a very small building and there was no way for secrets to be kept very long. Key players, government ministers, senators, lower house MPs, for them to move around the building to go from their office to the chamber or even to go to the bathroom would encounter journalists everywhere they went. At the time, journalists were taught to use King's Hall as a kind of waiting room to meet key players in the parliament. It's the central area in between the two chambers, and everyone coming and going from the parliament would go through that room, and you could sit yourself there and wait to see the people that you needed to speak to. I think what social media does in the modern parliament, just up the hill at Parliament House here, spreading news like wildfire, replaces what happened down the hill at Old Parliament House, where people spoke to each other and news moved really quickly. I think today social media and 24-hour news has the same effect in this much bigger building, where it's much harder to run into the people that you need to speak to because of the way the building is designed. The architecture promotes a bit more privacy and a bit more secrecy.
I happened to be talking to someone just last night who started the day in Queensland that day and ended up in Canberra. And something that really struck me was he really wanted to emphasise how he struggled to remember some of the little details. Like, he was trying to remember, were there public telephones available, for instance, to kind of, you know, call newsrooms or find out what was going on? Did you find that sort of in the witness accounts you got from journalists, did they always match up?
I think memory is pretty flexible sometimes, isn't it? We remember the most dramatic things and sometimes the less mundane details fall away. The great thing about the media reporting of the time, and of course there's so much of it, lots of newspaper coverage, live radio from the ABC, first-hand accounts over the decades since, is that there's great detail included in that. You know, the press gallery at Old Parliament House was spread out in a slightly different way to how we operate today. And there are accounts of people running around the building and bursting into bureaus to announce the news. There are accounts of people desperately trying to get to the building to be there to cover the events, trying to get news back to newsrooms all around the country. One detail that sticks out from me from my reading of the time is that the ABC News broadcast on the radio initially had trouble explaining and understanding what had actually happened, where the budget bills were up to, how the situation was going to play out. And I think that matches accounts of people who were there at the time, even members of parliament. It was unclear who the prime minister was, who was in government, exactly which parts of the constitutional framework were at play. And as the news emanated from the building all around the country and indeed all around the world, there are details that were initially maybe not fully formed or perhaps slightly incorrect that get corrected as the hours go. And in the 50 years since, you see the stories told and retold over and over again, and things shift so ever so slightly. I think that's what happens with history. It's certainly what happens with journalism.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're speaking to Tom McElroy, who is the political editor of The Guardian Australia, and we're talking about Gough Whitlam's dismissal 50 years ago, which we will mark on the 11th of November. Tom, I want to talk to you about the role of the media after the dismissal, because I was speaking to someone who said they were getting all of their information from the media at the time about what went on, as you just explained. And there was a real sense in some circles that Gough Whitlam had been hard done by. You know, the Governor General had crossed a line in dismissing him and overreached. And then I heard that Gough Whitlam would pop up in the media every day, reminding everybody that he was a victim of this decision. And from what I hear, I wasn't there at the time, but people got a bit over that narrative. They sort of wanted to move on with their lives when perhaps Gough Whitlam didn't want to move on. What sort of was the vibe in the media then of keeping that in the news cycle?
I'm envious of the reporters that were there at the time and got to cover this in real time. We look back with a historical lens, but this was their daily news and it would have been an extraordinary period. The government was dismissed on the afternoon of the 11th of November. By December 13, there had been an election for both houses of parliament. An election campaign period for us today is an intense period, but I can only imagine what it would have been like. Whitlam, after he delivers those iconic lines about nothing's being able to save the Governor General, tells Labor supporters to maintain their rage all the way to the election. Both sides of Parliament quickly pivoted to an election campaign. And I think the anger and excitement of the dismissal 50 years ago continued all the way through that period. But of course, history reminds us that Labor were trounced by the time the election came around. And I think the anger that Whitlam's supporters felt didn't translate necessarily across the whole country. The results of the election giving a big majority to Fraser and the coalition to form a permanent government going forward perhaps doesn't line up completely with the emotions of November 11 in Canberra and around the country.
Something else that the person I was chatting to about that day explained to me the experience on the day. He was a former journalist who was then working as a lobbyist. He had started the day working at a mine site somewhere for his employer in Queensland. The first he knew of it going on was when they told him the company Jet was waiting to fly him on to Canberra. So he had to jump on, still wearing shorts and a singlet, stop off in Brisbane on the way for his secretary to hand him a suit on the tarmac, and then on the Learjet flew to Canberra. And one of the things he said was that the bars where you would usually find journalists to find out what was going on were unusually quiet that night. And he had the sense that the journalists who actually knew what was happening were actually being quite protective of their angles or their stories. There wasn't a lot of sharing going on. Is that something that was reflected in the stories that you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think the chase for information was probably as strong as it ever is in politics. There's a bit of wisdom that goes around this building that when you see someone running, you should follow them and work out what's going on. And I think that was probably literally true on the day that the dismissal happened. Events were moving so quickly for the journalist to latch onto one piece of the story, one particular angle, meant that they might miss the subsequent events. By the time the government, the fate of the government is confirmed and those famous speeches happen outside Parliament, there's a big angry crowd gathered. People came from all over Canberra to gather outside Parliament to see the proclamation read, to hear Whitlam's speech. I think journalists then had a pretty speedy task to get a grasp of the historical significance, even the practicalities of the day, describe them to readers for the next day's newspapers, for TV and radio broadcasts that night, and then had a pretty quick turnaround to get ready for an election campaign. One thing that happened in between, Laurie Oakes tells this story, was a legendary dinner where politicians and journalists, after the deadlines of all the papers had passed, got together. He says it was a beauty of a night. I think more than a few drinks consumed, and probably the first time that the historical import, the gravity of the day, really registered with some of the journalists who were lucky enough to cover it.
That is a great kicking off point for my final question before we let you go, Tom. There's a lot of chatter around the relationship between politicians and political journalists in 2025. Sometimes we hear that they are actually a lot closer than newsreaders would think. They might go drinking together, as you described back in 1975, and they might be in, you know, metaphorical bed together. What is the relationship between political journalists and politicians in 2025?
Oh, it's a great question, and it's something people often ask me about how our jobs work. Look, we work together with politicians and their staff, we are all in the same building a lot of the time, and there's information sharing going back and forth. There are personal relationships, you know, people will go for a drink or perhaps go for dinner. But I think the important task for the press gallery is to maintain good separation. It's difficult sometimes to have a friendly relationship with someone, you know, not exactly colleagues, but working in the same place. When we need to write stories, break news that the politicians don't like, of course, that's the most important part of our job. And sometimes it can be difficult. But look, I think any journalist worth their salt cares more about the story, less about being friends or mates with the politician. That's an easy calculation, I think, for real journalists.
Very diplomatic answer there. Tom McElroy is the political editor of The Guardian Australia and the author of the 2025 book Blue Polls, Jackson Pollock, Gough Whitlam and the Painting That Changed a Nation. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Medialand today.
It was my great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Viv, we mentioned at the start of the program that we're on the Gold Coast, and it is for a very specific reason, not a holiday.
Yeah, we're here for one of the last upfronts of the media announcement season. Paramount and Ten's upfronts were at Dreamworld on the Gold Coast last night.
That's right, Viv, and we should mention that we were among the media and advertising guests who received flights and accommodation from Ten to attend the event. And tell me, Viv, how did it feel to sit in that iconic Big Brother chair? And did it spoil it that you were sitting next to me?
Well, what was so strange was we got to go into the Big Brother house, which is at Dreamworld. And I don't know if I'm silly for not appreciating this, Tim, but I didn't realise it's not a house. I grew up watching this show when it launched in 2001, and it's obviously coming back to 10 this weekend. And we got to do a tour, and it's essentially a soundstage in a warehouse. The walls don't go all the way to the roof. You look up and there's just silver insulation and very harsh television lighting. There's no windows because, of course, they've got to have all the cameras and all the producers back there. So I couldn't even pay attention to the fact that I was in the chair or whether or not I was next to you. I was so claustrophobic and so stressed being in there. I think it was a real reality check, especially when we also went into the toilets and there were cameras there, that I would be a terrible Big Brother housemate. It was definitely fascinating, but not for me in the long term.
And we should probably mention there are other announcements as well. This wasn't just the launch of Big Brother, which happens on Sunday night. This was 10 and Paramount talking about their plans for Australia. Of course, Paramount only quite recently under new billionaire ownership as part of Skydance. So a few new announcements. We saw Traitors, the TV show, coming back with Gretel Colleen as the host.
Yes, she used to be the host of Big Brother back in the day. And so she was sort of on stage, and so was Mel Tresina, the new host of Big Brother. So it did really feel like a bit of nostalgia and a bit of renewal.
Well, from always watching to always listening, please remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And what's your dream Australian production to make with the new streamer money? What's your big pitch? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.